From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix.
And I'm Celeste Headlee in Washington. It's Here and Now. A new school year is beginning, and we're getting a picture of how severe learning loss has been since the pandemic began. Testing by the National Assessment of Educational Progress shows a significant drop in scores for fourth graders during the past 2 years. Joining us now is Andrew Ho, a professor of education at Harvard University and former member of the National Assessment Governing Board. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
So this test is sometimes called the Nation's Report Card. It was administered just before the pandemic shutdown in 2020 and then again this year. And in that two-year span, there's been a big drop, down 5 points in reading, 7 points in math overall. How significant are these results, do you think?
They are substantial. They confirm other research that we've been hearing about over the past couple of years, and it shows unprecedented declines and, I think, more importantly, worsening educational inequality.
In order to really understand the significance of these results, though, wouldn't we need to compare them apples to apples? In other words, has there ever been a disruption like this before in which we could see how long it took students to recover and move forward?
Yeah, that's a good question. So one way to think about this, right, is that over the past 20, 30 years, you can break results down into decades, right? There was essentially a decade of moderate educational progress as a country from the late 90s to the early 2000s. And then from the time of the recession through the 2010s, there was a period of worsening educational inequality. And what's happened over the past 3 years is that that decade of progress from the late 90s to through the 2000s was essentially erased. And the inequality has been exacerbated.
Well, speaking of inequality, this data show students who were struggling before the pandemic actually lost the most ground over the past 2 years. Their scores fell up to 12 points, while those who were doing the best lost just 2 or 3 points. Why do you think this disparity exists?
Those declines by the relatively low-scoring students are 4 times as much as the declines from the relatively high-scoring students. And that just shows that this has not just been a health disaster, but essentially an educational challenge as well. But one thing is clear, we definitely have our work cut out for us. And again, not just for all kids, but particularly kids who are initially low-scoring.
There's also a significant difference in scores depending on where the students lived. Math scores fell furthest in the Midwest, for example. Do we have any way of putting that into context?
Yes. I think the most important data that are going to come out on that are going to be from the National Assessment of Educational Progress, the same test, in just over a month. So this test that we have here is called the long-term trend. It only offers results at a national level and a regional level. But in just over a month, the same assessment program, the Nation's Report Card, is also going to be offering results for each and every state and a large number of large districts. So that will give us an even clearer sense of the work we need to do and where we need to do it.
So this is one test of one age group, 9-year-olds who are mostly in the fourth grade. How much can these scores really tell us about all school-age kids in all grades? I mean, is it fair to use this test as sort of a barometer for education right now?
I think it's important whenever we look at a test to put this in context. The other research to date has shown that these results tend to generalize. Some states and some districts show that it was worse in earlier grades, others that it was more stable across grades. But again, whenever we look at test scores, remember, this is only one kind of outcome that we care about for our kids, but it's still sending a pretty clear signal, and combined with other research across grades and across other outcomes, we are definitely seeing, again, declines and worsening inequality.
Anything else you might tell worried parents? Of course, I know that you've done a lot of research in the misuse of some of the statistics where people will take test scores and actually use them to set state and federal policy. What might you say to a very worried parent at this point?
This is a really important question. We tend to look at numbers and see only deficits, only gaps, right? I think it's important for national leaders to address those gaps with policies that pay our debts that we owe to our kids. When it comes to individual teachers and parents and school leaders who are working with kids, I hope we don't see their deficits. I hope we see their assets, and I hope we can build from them. So I hope this inspires us and doesn't focus us on what we've lost and instead points a way forward. But it should be a clarion call to policymakers and people in control of educational funding that this is a serious issue and that we need to pay, again, the debts that I think we owe to our kids that have been worsened, in particular for relatively lower scoring kids over the past couple of years.
Andrew Ho is a professor of education at Harvard University and former member of the National Assessment Governing Board. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
For the first time ever, a woman will represent Alaska in the U.S. House of Representatives. Mary Peltola is a Democrat who will go to Washington as Alaska's only representative in the House after the results of last month's special election were finalized last night. Peltola defeated two high-profile Republicans, including former Alaska governor and vice presidential nominee Sarah Palin. Reporter Candace Norwood from the 19th followed the race, and she's on the line with us now. Candace, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So in addition to being the first woman to represent Alaska, Mary Peltola is also the first Alaska native to win a seat in Congress. Tell us more about who she is and the history that she's just achieved.
Yeah, Mary Peltola is someone who didn't have a lot of name recognition coming into this race, but she did serve in the Alaska House of Representatives for 10 years until 2009 and worked in a few local positions and commissions in the years since. But she slowly kind of built a name for herself, specifically kind of tying her roots to Alaska and her interest in really elevating issues that affect everyday Alaskans.
And what were some of those issues that helped decide this race?
Alaska has a very interesting position as a place that really has a lot of economic value that comes from oil production and fishing industries like that, but is also heavily affected by things like climate change. And so I think Peltola was able to speak to navigating kind of the need to beef up those industries and support those industries while understanding some of the impacts that can occur from certain ways of producing energy. And I think that is really kind of a central point to her success in this race, in addition to the ranked choice voting, because Sarah Palin, even though she has the national name recognition, has received some criticism from voters for being disconnected from Alaska and kind of the lived experiences there.
Okay, you mentioned ranked choice voting. Let's talk about that, because this is an election where voters picked their top three candidates in order of preference, and that's one of the reasons that it took so long to tabulate the results here. What role do you think ranked choice voting had propelling a Democrat past two pretty well-known Republicans?
Yeah, I mean, certainly not to take away from the success that Peltola had in this race, but ranked choice voting is an important factor. Alaska has a history of voting Republican. For this special House race, the congressman who's being replaced after his death is Republican and held the seat for nearly 50 years. Ranked choice voting, in a way, kind of split the Republican votes. We have had another Republican competing in this race, Nick Begich. And so it's safe to say that splitting the Republican vote in a way allowed this Alaska Native Democrat to come through and shine.
Okay, so this is an important point because Democrats are going to be eager to tout this as a big win for the party just ahead of the midterms, where they're trying to keep control of the House and the Senate. But because this was a special election to replace a Republican, Don Young, who died, she's going to have to go back on the ballot in November. What are the prospects in the fall for Peltola and the other candidates that ran in this special election?
It's hard to say exactly how things will stack up. I mean, Peltola is getting a lot more attention than even she had prior to this race. All of the headlines will definitely be a factor in raising people's curiosity about who she is, right? And possibly digging into what she would represent as a member of Congress for two more years. Peltola has positioned herself as really wanting to elevate the bipartisan reputation that the congressman before her had and trying to navigate between the various issues and understanding the nuances of the ways that Alaskans perceive issues like abortion, for example. Mm. Abortion is something that Alaskans have shown to be overwhelmingly in favor of. Some want limitations on the legality of it, but it's not this overwhelming desire for a ban on abortion.
Right. Alaska has an independent streak in it, even though it often goes Republican. Now, listen, you work for the 19th, a publication that focuses on gender. So just, you know, briefly, what are people reflecting on today as we talk about a candidate who just broke some pretty significant glass ceilings?
It's important to know that women candidates who run for politics often aren't doing this. It's just saying, vote for me because I'm a woman. But that's obviously a factor in who they are and their identity, right? And so Petola, for example, can connect to an issue like the child tax credit in a way that maybe someone else might not be able to connect with that issue. Her Alaska Native background and being a woman, that's all a factor. And not only is she the first Alaska Native to hold this position, but she's also the first woman to hold this seat as well.
Candace Norwood is a reporter from the 19th. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We've been hearing from a lot of you about the Biden administration's historic student loan forgiveness plan, and our takeaway is that a lot of people out there are confused. So we're going to take a few minutes now to hear from a couple of listeners, and then we're going to bring in an expert to help us answer some of their questions. Let's start with Cecilia Marino of Bozeman, Montana, who says she has no idea how to start the process.
It looks complicated.
But she still hopes the Biden plan will cut her debt in half.
Nothing's ever easy with all the forms to fill out. So hopefully it works and I don't just have my hopes up.
Cecilia is 70 years old and she never thought she'd still be making payments at this age.
So I never went to university until I was 52. Once I, you know, raised my three kids, I came late to all this education and loans.
Cecilia graduated in 2006 with about $20,000 in student loan debt. Her balance now, still $20,000. She says even though she makes regular payments, the interest adds up and makes it tough to reduce her balance. And this issue is affecting her adult children, too.
My oldest son, with what he owes, he will never pay it off. You know, because he owes over, I believe it's with his wife also, over $200,000. And at 6% and 8%, it just keeps accumulating. All he can pay every month is the interest.
The way debt stresses a family is something that worries Samantha Neugebauer, a teacher from Baltimore, Maryland.
I'm newly married, and my husband and I have been talking about starting a family, and these loans are really hanging over our heads. Even his, and he's not American, so it's all new to him, and I've been feeling very guilty about that.
Samantha owes $100,000, so she's applied for public service loan forgiveness, a separate federal program to wipe out debt for people who've worked for years as public servants. While Samantha waits for final approval, she wonders how her current debt will change future life decisions.
I guess my question would be about how people who have significant student loan debts should think about paying off debt versus like creating wealth in terms of buying property or, you know, investing in the stock market and such. Because if I had decided not to go into the nonprofit sector, I would probably be carrying around student loan debt for a really good portion of my life.
Lifelong debt is something Brian Vlasic of the Boston area sees as inevitable.
Right now, I'm functionally homeless. And that's not what I expected to be doing when I graduated with a PhD in 2007.
Brian has about $250,000 in student debt. And because they had Pell Grants, they are eligible for $20,000 in relief under the Biden plan. But that doesn't go far enough on a loan that Brian can't afford to pay. This reality has led to some soul searching.
This year is, for me personally, has been all the worse. You know, I was recently diagnosed with epilepsy and had a couple major head strikes. And as a result, I was completely removed from the workforce altogether, and I could no longer drive a car and, you know, all that. And it only made me question myself more, because I know the discourse in social media that surrounds the idea of not being able to pay back student loans. And are you a freeloader? Are you someone who is taking advantage of the system? Are you a con artist? Or do you just have really bad luck? I mean, I certainly don't view myself as a freeloader trying to take advantage of the system, but I know a lot of other people may see that differently.
A final thought that Brian brings up and that all three borrowers can agree on: education is priceless.
It's the most precious thing we have. It's the only thing no one can take away from you. It's your education.
All right, let's bring in our expert now. Betsy Mayotte is founder of the Institute of Student Loan Advisors. Betsy, we spoke with you just after the White House made this announcement that it would forgive $10,000 in loan debt for anyone making less than $125,000 a year and $20,000 of loan forgiveness for lower income people who went to college on Pell Grants. We're glad to have you back. Thank you.
Thanks for having me back.
And first of all, what'd you think listening to those three borrowers?
I wish I could tell you that I was surprised, but I'm not. I hear stories like that every single day from the consumers that reach out to us for advice and help. It also just reinforced why we do what we do, because, you know, we have answers for them. We have solutions, and it shouldn't be so difficult for student loan borrowers to be able to find those answers.
Well, let's try to get to some of the questions then. You told us last time that borrowers need to be patient because the process here could take many months. I want to start with Cecilia's question about paperwork, which seems complicated to her and kind of daunting. She thinks she qualifies for $10,000 in relief. Where does she start and when should she start?
Well, I don't know if Cecilia has a lead of, you know, insider information that we don't have, but there is no process yet. So it's a little early to say that it's complicated. In fact, we know for a fact that for about 8 million borrowers, they're not going to have to do anything. It's just magically going to happen on their accounts because the Department of Education already has access to their income information. For everybody else, we don't know what the process is going to look like yet. I do know that the Department of Education, they said that we can expect that in October, so just a few weeks, they will be making an announcement and making available an app or a link on their website that borrowers can use to submit whatever information they're going to be required to submit. You know, I wrote down for Cecilia all the forms. I would be surprised if there was more than one form, if there was a form at all. So I wouldn't get anxious about the process yet until we see what it looks like.
Okay, perception might be worse than reality then in this case. Now, right. I also know you've been warning people to watch out for fraud. Why is that?
Well, it started the day of the announcement. Scammers are always ready to take advantage of that set of consumers that is feeling vulnerable. So I can tell your listeners this. Nobody is ever going to call you from a legitimate source offering to, quote unquote, help you with the Biden forgiveness. There also isn't going to be anybody on the planet. That includes me. That includes Secretary Cardona. That includes President Biden. That is going to be able to rush your forgiveness through or get you to the front of the line. So don't ever, ever pay a fee, as far as I'm concerned, for anything involved with your student loans, but certainly regarding this forgiveness that was announced last week.
Okay, good advice. Now, another thing that was unclear to Cecilia and to other borrowers: does this forgiveness plan cover interest or is it just principal?
So one of the things that we're waiting for guidance on is how they're going to apply the forgiveness. I'm not sure if they're going to apply it first to principal or to principal and interest. That's going to be a wait and see. The other related question I get, if I could preempt it, is will the consumer have a choice as to how the forgiveness is applied as far as which loan or to principal or interest? And that's something else that we're in wait and see mode for.
All right, and let's dig into Brian's situation. Brian still has hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt. The president's plan is only going to make a small dent in those balances. Brian's not alone. There are many people in this situation. What are some other programs they should be looking into? What do you advise?
Well, you know, when Brian first started talking, the first thing I thought of was public service loan forgiveness. He mentioned that he got his PhD, But then as he continued to tell his story and he mentioned his recent diagnosis that has made it that he's unable to work, he should look into total and permanent disability discharge, which if he qualifies would forgive his debt entirely. And I just want to add, he shouldn't feel guilty about that. These programs were put in place for a reason, and he should stop worrying about what other people think. If he needs the help and he qualifies for the program, that's what it's there for, and he shouldn't hesitate to look into it.
Exactly. All right. So our listener, Samantha, had a pretty practical question, but an important one. If you end up carrying a huge amount of debt for many years of your life, which this was her situation and Brian's, how should you think about building wealth, buying a house, maybe investing in the stock market? Are those goals just out of reach?
Oh, not necessarily. But there also isn't a single answer to that question. A lot of it depends on the financial personality of the consumer, and it depends on what is most important to the consumer. There's some people that we work with that they just want to get out of debt. That's what's most important to them. So they, you know, put everything else aside for a couple of years and, you know, make some sometimes strict budget choices with the goal of getting rid of their student loans and other debt as quickly as possible. And then they start building wealth, looking into saving for a house and so on. There's other people that have the opposite. It's more important to them to buy that first home, start saving for retirement aggressively, so they pay the minimums on their loans. And they understand that that could result in them paying more interest, but they're pursuing what to them is the most important thing. And then there's other people that do middle ground. They work hard on their budget to figure out what they can do to minimize the interest they pay on their loans, but still be able to pursue their other financial goals. And that's the ideal solution, is to be able to do both.
Betsy Mayotte is founder of the Institute of Student Loan Advisors, with some advice for people who are saddled with student loan debt. I'm sure they will appreciate it, and we appreciate you.
Thank you very much.
And Betsy also has recommendations for a few different places you can go if you want more answers to your student debt questions. Check them out at hereandnow.org, and good luck to you.
So is Serena Williams really ready to retire?
The legend lives on.
Nope, that was Williams defeating the number two player in the world, Estonian Anett Kontaveit, yesterday evening at the U.S. Open. Williams had been struggling after a hiatus caused by injury. She seems to have recovered pretty well, though. Here to talk about what's next for Serena Williams is New York Times tennis correspondent Christopher Clary. Hi, Christopher.
Hi, Celeste.
So what was the atmosphere like yesterday at Ash Stadium?
I have to say, I've been covering tennis for 35 years at the Grand Slam level, and what happened on Monday night in her first round match with Serena when she beat Kovanich in that atmosphere, and then again last night, was exceptional. Never seen anything like it. You feel like you're at a World Cup final or an NBA Game 7. It's just an immense amount of volume, immense amount of love, and there's absolutely no ambiguity. They are for Serena and pulling her through.
So she had an iconic response when she was interviewed on the court last night, right after the game. Here's that exchange.
Are you surprising yourself with your level?
No, I know.
I mean, I'm just Serena, you know, so.
You say, Christopher, that's not bravado on her part. This is hard-earned confidence. Why do you say that?
That was a classic Serena there. The self-confidence in Serena hasn't maybe, it's just unshakable, having watched her over the years. She has so many memories of having been through tough situations and prevailed. 2007 Australian Open, she was ranked in the 80s, playing pretty rotten tennis, came in and ran the table. 2012, she was first round loss at the French Open, then came back and won Wimbledon right away, and then played probably the best tennis of her career at the Olympics and getting the gold medal in London. So she has plenty of memories of turning things around quickly. She knows what she's capable of. She knows she's a great champion. And I think at times like this, when she has so much to play for and wants to go out on a good note, it's all coming through.
There will also be high expectations tonight because Serena Williams is playing doubles with her sister Venus. This could be their last competitive game together. Who are they playing against?
You know, they are playing on Ash Stadium again, so there'll be more volume and no ambiguity again tonight. They're playing against Lucy Radetska and Linda Noshkova, who are a Czech team, a 37-year-old and a 17-year-old, who have never experienced anything like this, remotely like this atmosphere they're about to face tonight. And Serena and Venus haven't played a Grand Slam doubles tournament together in 4 years. They've won all 14 of their Grand Slam finals and doubles, which is an amazing stat. And this is such a poignant moment. These are two sisters who came up together. They're connected in the public eye, and now they're going to be playing in this amazing arena with all kinds of, I think, emotions swirling around in their own heads and in the crowd's heads.
Christopher, we have less than 30 seconds left, but I wonder, are you going to miss covering Serena?
You know what? Every day when you come to work, when Serena has played, you know the public wants to read about her for 27 years, so that'll be hard to replace.
Christopher Cleary is the New York Times tennis correspondent. Thanks so much. Author Emiko Jean is perhaps best known for her books for young adults, the best-selling Tokyo Ever After and its sequel, Tokyo Dreaming, both books centered around a Japanese-American girl from a small Northern California town who struggles to define herself after she finds out she's the daughter of the Crown Prince of Japan. Now Emiko Jean is out with her first book for grown-ups. It's called Mika in Real Life, and as the title implies, the book's central character also deals with identity issues, and Emiko Jean joins me now to talk about it. Hi there.
Hi.
You know, one of the things that really struck me in this book is the consequences of white lies.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be very careful not to give away any spoilers here, but it's pretty early on that she tells this one little lie that kind of grows out of control.
Mm-hmm.
Was that just a plot device for you, or were you trying to say something there?
You know, it started as a plot point, but it really became so much more as I dive deeper into the reason why someone would tell a lie or fake a life. And one of the angles that I kind of latched onto was social media, and that a lot of people kind of put out there what they want others to see while hiding a lot of things. It's kind of the tip of the iceberg. And I was really interested in that, like why people felt like they had to pretend they have a different life than they really do.
This idea of pretending you are something other than you are comes up again and again in a bunch of different ways in the book. And another one that happens early on is the differing views that Mika has of her daughter's name as opposed to the way her daughter views her name. Now, Mika, for the benefit of our listeners, has a child when she's very young, and she gives that child up for adoption. And she names the daughter, her daughter, Penny, and insists that when the young girl and the baby is adopted, they keep the name Penny. Tell me a little bit about why Penny wishes she had a name that was more Japanese.
Yeah. So Penny is a teenager, and she is half Japanese, and she was adopted to white parents. And she struggles a lot with her identity and wanting to feel more connected to that Japanese part of herself. And she wishes that she had a Japanese name that kind of embodied that. I think, you know, for Mika, it was important that Penny have a strong name, an aspirational name. In the book, Mika goes into what the name Penny means, and she hopes that will give her kind of this strength as she voyages on into her adopted family without her birth mother. And so it was really, you know, Mika had great intentions when she gave Penny her name, but Penny really longed to have that cultural touchstone, which launches Penny on this journey to find her birth mom and to reconnect with her lost Japanese identity.
You know, this issue of not just identity, but who one's people are, who is your tribe, mm-hmm. right, comes up mm-hmm. again and again for Penny, but it also comes up for Mika. We get this sense that Penny has never felt that she fully fit in her family, or that she was yeah. fully comfortable in her own skin there. Can you tell me a little bit more about that? And I say that because this is not just about a Japanese American or somebody who's an adoptee. As a person myself of mixed race, I found myself really identifying with some of the things Penny was grappling with.
Yeah. So it mirrors my own identity as a Japanese American, that like struggle living between those two identities in the hyphen, right? And never feeling like I was enough Japanese or enough American, and trying to, you know, navigate both of those parts of myself.
Did you find that having to work this out on the page helped you, not to, you know, harken back to the title, but helped you in real life?
I do. A lot of my work, my debut novel featured a white protagonist, but all my novels since have had Japanese or Japanese American protagonists. And that has been part of my journey as redefining myself and also rediscovering myself as a Japanese American and really exploring what it means to be a yellow body in the United States.
I found it really engaging, but I also really liked the main character, Mika. And one of the things I really liked about her is that she's a hot mess when we first meet her. she doesn't have it together. I'm struggling because I don't want to give away too many details, mm-hmm. but she starts the book by losing her job. She doesn't live in her own place. You know, things are messy for her. Why was that important to have a main character who just hadn't figured things out yet?
You know, in some ways, Mika deconstructs the model minority myth that Asian Americans are high achievers and that they do well academically and that they're quiet. And she's none of those things. She's pretty much the antithesis of all of those things.
Yeah.
And she's also a woman, her Japanese, you know, American identity aside, she's a woman that's been traumatized before. And so this has kind of frozen her. And so she is a mess, but there's a lot going on underneath her skin and what she projects out into the world of why she has had this inaction in her life. And it's really, you know, the novel spends a lot of time unpacking that and really figuring out who she is.
Yeah. And it's a lovely journey to watch and also feel like that you are a part of, because it feels to me like she and Penny are kind of figuring it out together, which brings us to that relationship between parent and child. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of different relationships that reflect that bond, right, in this book. There's, mm-hmm. of course, the biological relationship. We don't know for a very, very long time who Penny's biological father is. There's the adoptive parents. What were you trying to explore here when it comes to parent and child bonding?
You know, I think I was trying to definitely explore parental bonds, but also how diverse and varied they can be. And to a certain extent, I was also trying to make the point, or actually searching myself for this answer, I think, is that there's really no right way to be a parent, to become a parent, or to parent kids, that we're all just trying the best that we can.
How different was it for you to write a book where your audience, the person that you're imagining as you write, reading it, is an adult and not a kid?
You know, I didn't struggle very much with that. I always knew from the beginning of this novel that it was going to be an adult novel. I myself had just had twins. I just had children. And so I was really kind of examining who I was as a mother and who my kids were going to be later on in life, and if they were going to be like me as a teen. And I think those all of those things got wrapped up into the novel.
And you're ready to write another adult novel? Was this a one-off?
No, I definitely plan on writing more adult novels. I have one that I've outlined and I'm ready to start. I can't say too much about it, but there are more in me.
I guess that would be super spoilers to give things away about a book that hasn't even been published yet. Do your characters sometimes surprise you in the choices they make?
Yeah, they do. At the beginning of Mika in real life, I had never intended for a certain relationship to develop. I'm trying not to give away spoilers. It's so tricky. But once I had started drafting these characters and putting them on the page, there was just such obvious chemistry between the two that I kind of had to deviate from the outline that I was working on and let these characters kind of lead me in the direction that they, you know, wanted to go.
So as you come away from this novel and start working on the next, I wonder what advice you would give to someone who is in a similar place to you, who is grappling with their own identity and trying to figure out how to navigate that hyphen, whatever that may be, Japanese American or any other identity. Do you have any guidance?
I think for me, one of the most powerful things in my life has been those found families. So people that are, you know, outside of your immediately family, but that are similar to you and that you can connect with, you know, regarding those issues. And as a byproduct of publishing novels like this and novels like Tokyo Ever After, I've widened that community tenfold. I'm hoping that people can connect with the work and see my own journey and see a reflection of their journey.
Emiko Jean's book is Mika in Real Life. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
If you've been to a stadium for a sporting event, surely you've seen or joined in on the wave. It's kind of a fun distraction, right? Especially if the game isn't going your way. Well, some baseball players and purists hate it. Colorado Public Radio's Vic Vela spoke to fans, many of whom say, dude, lighten up.
Ah, baseball. It's our national pastime. Christina Torres is a big baseball fan, and every time she makes it to Denver's Coors Field to cheer on her beloved Colorado Rockies, she always joins along with other fans doing the wave.
Yeah, because it gets everybody excited and woo! Yep. Love it.
Does it look fun when you see it on the other side?
Oh, and yeah, because you know that it's coming around to you and you get excited and it's like, oh, it's our turn and woo! Yep.
That sound Christina was making, the one where she goes,
woo!
That's typically what people say whenever the wave approaches their section. They stand, throw their arms up in the air, and let out a big
woo!
And then they sit back down. And then the next section does it, and the next, and so on and so on. It's usually an exuberant person or group of people who start the wave, and they're pretty proud of themselves when they do, like in this Saturday Night Live clip with Phil Hartman and Jeff Goldblum.
Son, this is just like when my dad used to take me to the ballpark.
Excuse me. No, that's not exactly true. That's not true, son.
You talking to me?
Yeah, that's right. This is not like when your dad took you to the ballpark. Nowadays, people like myself start waves, which make the game much more fun. Your son is having more fun now than you had with your father because of me. I'm the reason. Do you see that?
For Rockies fan Reza Zahedi, the wave has real meaning.
We literally do the wave at Thanksgiving dinner. We've got like 26 of us around the table. We do the wave.
So you love it that much, it's actually a family thing.
Yeah, this is something my uncle started, and then we commemorate his mother that passed away a couple years ago, and we do the wave for her.
That's actually really poignant.
Yeah. So
beautiful.
Of course I'm going to do the wave at the baseball game.
Fans of the wave say it's a fun way to get everyone at the stadium involved in something, and it looks cool when a good one gets going. Evan Shanalik of Kansas City is a big fan of the wave. End of 1980s romantic comedies, apparently.
In the hit movie When Harry Met Sally, you see them do the wave at the Giants game, and I've always wanted to be a part of it.
So I say to her, don't you love me anymore? You know what she says? I don't know if I've ever loved you.
Ooh, that's harsh.
So fans love it. Jeff Goldblum, Billy Crystal love it. Who doesn't love the wave?
It's something that I think is a stupid thing in sports, especially baseball.
Whoa, that's Rockies pitcher Kyle Freeland throwing a curveball at this point in the story.
It's something that does distract me. I don't need a bunch of people standing up and waving their arms, you know, as I'm trying to execute a pitch.
Freeland recalls a game in Philadelphia earlier this year when he was about to throw a pitch, but then saw the wave coming down the first baseline. So he waited for it to pass before throwing. Freeland says when you do that, it could break a pitcher's rhythm.
I've grown in the game where I've learned, okay, like I can take a step off, I can take another breath, I can reset here and then go. I've found a way where, you know, I'll know where the wave's at. If I need to step off and, you know, take my time, take 5 seconds to let it go by, I'm going to do that.
Jenny Kavnar agrees with Freeland. She's part of the Rockies broadcast team, and Jenny shakes her head whenever fans do the wave, especially during a close game.
A 3-2 ball game at Coors Field or a tied ball game at Coors Field, late innings, packed house, like Rockies on defense. It's, like I want to scream. I do. Listen, I am fun. I'm all fun. I'm not a no fun broadcaster. I like to have a great time. And I have little kids and I want them to have fun at the game. But I will teach them that if you are going to wave, wave when the game is out of hand. And do not wave when your pitcher is on the mound in a tight game. Don't do it.
Longtime Rockies beat writer Thomas Harding couldn't help but overhear Jenny's comments, and he just had to chime in.
The wave is like a sunrise. The wave's like a sunset. It's like the ocean. It's like a hillside. The wave is always beautiful. It's always beautiful. It pulls you in. It doesn't keep you out. What? How could you dislike the wave?
This is so poetic of you. I love it.
I know. I mean, Jenny's wonderful, but I was dying 1,000 deaths during this interview. 1,000 deaths. The wave. Wave forever.
And Matt King of Florida has a name for people who growl over the wave.
They're crybabies. Complete crybabies.
Are you crying? Are you crying? There's no crying. There's no crying in baseball.
Hey, you can call her all the names you want, but Jenny Kavnar's mind is made up.
If you want to have a good time in the late innings and your team has a big lead, then go for it. Do you. But, like, know when to wave and know when not to wave, okay?
You got to know when to hold up. Know when to fold up. Know when to walk away. And know when to run.
Kenny Rogers probably wasn't thinking about the wave when he sang these lyrics, but baseball purists would appreciate it if fans knew when to hold them and when to fold them before throwing their hands up to do the wave.
When to hold them, know when to fold them.
For Here and Now,
woo!
I'm Vic Vella.
My prayer of gratitude for that story, Here and Now, is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Peter O'Dowd, waving from Phoenix.
Woo! I'm Celeste Headley in Bethesda, Maryland. It's Here and Now.